any preliminary issues? Questions? By the way, I don't know how many people have tried to access the DVD that was at the circulation desk. There were some issues or difficulties getting it to run, and I'm still working on that. If you would like to be able to look at that, it's the exam grading DVD. If you want to see that, let me know, and I'll make sure you're able to get a copy that works. Yeah. Here's where we are, or at least here's the schedule. The last week of class, which is the week after Thanksgiving, is devoted to review. So there is no new coverage after Thanksgiving. Instead, what I do is basically invite you to ask me questions. On the last day of coverage, which will be Tuesday before Thanksgiving, I'll give you the condensed outline, which is about 6 pages long, of what we've covered to that point. That gives us 5 classes between now and then. I don't anticipate being all the way through damages, but who knows? We may have a favorable tailwind here and get blown all the way through it. But I take, you know, we get wherever we get. As of the time I finished coverage of new material, I'll draw a line, and if we're in the middle of a case, you know, push it back to some meaningful cutoff point and say that's the part for which you are responsible. Then we'll pick up in January with wherever we left off and press on from there. Other, yeah. No. Some professors, issues about, classroom management are part of the a historic academic freedom that professors enjoy, subject to some limitations. That's essentially an individual decision. As is, for example, things like the grading process, which will differ from professor to professor. One of the major differences I might point out is between those who treat the first semester as kind of an independent semester, which is my approach. The grade you get is essentially a stable grade. Other professors treat it as kind of a provisional dipstick reading, and depending on how you do on the final exam in the spring, that has a greater weight. And, there are pros and cons to each approach, and so each professor gets to decide what they think is the best way to teach. Yeah. What's that? No. Actually, there will be 2 big questions. And as you'll see from the previous exams, they are weighted so that, and I put a point total on each question corresponding to what I think is the relative amount of time it will take. So it's divided up. I figure by the time you finish outlining and preparing and leaving time for proofreading, you have 135 minutes to actually write, and of those, they're divided up, let's say, into 75 and 60 or 55 and 80 or some other split like that, so that as you look at it, you say, oh, this is the question the professor thinks is going to take me more time and has more weight, and then you can allocate your time proportionately. But 2 questions, And as you'll see, again, from looking at the past exams, they vary in terms of whether they emphasize, you know, one's really about breach of duty, and the causation questions are very modest and kind of a gimme. Other questions may have a pretty obvious breach of duty. I had, you know, one year where the guy's consumed 13 glasses of cognac, gets in his car, winds up on the wrong side of the freeway, wipes out a family. The breach of duty question is not hard in that case. It's damages that's hard, causation, etc. So again, one of the challenges, more so in this next exam than it was in the last exam, is to figure out what do I need to talk about here? Do I need an extended discussion of vicarious liability? Do I need an extended discussion of superseding cause? Or is this question more about res ipsa, abnormally dangerous activities, and the measure of damages under the wrongful death statute? So kind of picking your battles is as much a challenge as once I've picked my battle, doing well in explaining the law and applying. So again, look at the past exams as a guide. I think you'll see a fairly consistent pattern. Other preliminary questions? Okay, well then let's return to this issue of wrongful birth, and today we extend that into the area of wrongful life. Again, the common theme here, as I mentioned yesterday, is that the defendant's negligence results in the birth of children who are claimed by the parents and in Harbison by themselves to be a source of damage. And the question then arises, well, are we going to go there? How are we going to work this out? So can somebody tell us about Harbison? Mr. Fowler. Okay, so let's do the facts here. Identoin. Dilantin, yeah. Right. And when does this occur? When does her seizure disorder manifest itself? Okay, but she's actually pregnant with her first child, Michael, when they discover she's got this seizure disorder, and they prescribe Dilantin for her seizure disorder. And from, again, the facts are so important here that the seizure disorder was was sufficiently hazardous that despite the risks associated with taking this medication, there really wasn't any alternative. Notice that if there were an alternative, if, for example, there were a weaker medication, wasn't as good at avoiding seizures, but it was safe for pregnancy. And we would say, gee, a reasonable doctor would have prescribed a different medication for her so that during her pregnancy she could control her seizure disorder, have her children, then go back on this better medication, Dilantin, when she's not pregnant. If that were the situation, then this wouldn't be a wrongful birth, wrongful life claim. They wanted more children if they could have healthy children. So if there were a way to have healthy children and control her seizure disorder, they would have had two normal, healthy kids, and then they and their kids could say, your negligence resulted in my otherwise normal and healthy kids having fetal Hydantoin syndrome. But alas, apparently, that is not realistic. The only two options, I'm assuming, because no plaintiff's lawyer would venture into this wrongful birth, wrongful life stuff if you didn't have to. If there were a way to say that they could have avoided fetal Hydantoin syndrome and still had those children, I mean, one assumes the plaintiff's lawyer would have leapt at that. But apparently the only two alternatives are have children and take Dilantin, or get pregnant, take Dilantin to control your seizure disorder, or don't have kids. There is no third option, apparently. Again, I'm just assuming this, working backwards from essentially nothing else makes sense here. So, assuming that's the case, their options are don't have any more children, or have children but take the risk of side effects from Dilantin. That's the situation they're in. Now, what did the physician tell the parents about the risk of Dilantin? Cleft palate and hirsutism, as I recall. Hirsutism means excess hair. So apparently the parents, having been warned, gee, taking this medication while you're pregnant could result in children that have cleft palate or hirsutism, the parents say, well, that's a risk we're willing to take. But in telling them that, apparently the doctor was negligent. The doctor should have told them, instead, taking Dilantin puts your children at risk of having fetal Hydantoin syndrome. Here is what that looks like. What does fetal Hydantoin syndrome look like? It sounds kind of like Down syndrome. If you know people with Down syndrome, I happen to have a daughter with Down syndrome. So it looks a lot like, I mean, from the description, if you can imagine the risk of having a child with Down syndrome. And so again, the parents are saying, gee, if we had known that's what we were facing, we would have made the decision not to have a child. But not knowing that, thinking that it's only cleft palate and hirsutism that could happen to them, they proceed to have first Elizabeth, or is it Christine? Okay, so we got Elizabeth, and then 20 months later, 15 months later, 13 months later, Christine is born, both of whom have fetal Hydantoin syndrome. And at that point, the parents, consult their doctors and so forth, figure all this stuff out, and file their lawsuit. Now, what's the now let's talk about the law. What does the law, or first of all, I think I mentioned before the procedural aspect of this. The case is filed. It's a Federal Tort Claims Act case. We'll talk about that in Chapter 4, when the United States government or its employees does something negligent. You have to file a claim in federal court, but the federal court uses the law of the state where the tort occurred, in this case, Washington. So it's filed in the Eastern District of Washington, or the Western District, someplace in Washington. I think it's in the Eastern District, actually, our federal courthouse down the road here. And the judge takes the looks at the case and said, well, I've got to apply Washington law. But as I look to Washington law, I can't find anything. There's nothing in the case law suggesting what the Washington what Washington law is on this point. And as I think I mentioned before, one of the options a federal judge has in such cases is to certify the question to the Supreme Court of the state of Washington, seeking, in effect, a legal opinion, so that instead of this being an appeal from a case already decided, it's a what if, or, you know, kind of general, give us the state of the law on this point. So the Washington State Supreme Court now has to resolve these certified questions. And in particular, has to figure out whether there's a cause of action for wrongful birth. What does the Washington Supreme Court say with respect to a claim for wrongful birth? So the court actually, this is one of those cases where I feel a little bit better that I've given you the traditional Hornbook law on what a tort case is, duty, breach, causation, damages. And as you know, I've tended to take breach of duty as a single question, and here the court divides it up, and you can see how difficult it is to decide the duty question by itself. The defendant could argue in this case that the doctor owed no duty to these children because the children didn't exist when the doctor acted with alleged negligence. How can you owe a duty to someone, talk about remote, they're not even in existence yet? The court actually doesn't have much of a problem with that. And when you think about it for a moment, the idea of extending a duty of care to persons not yet in existence is not all that strange. If I build somebody a house and I put in the wiring and I construct the roof and do all this other stuff, and the purchaser of the house then moves in and they have a young child, and then the house falls down and the child gets injured, could the child sue me, the builder, because when I built the house I did so negligently? Well, yeah. I mean, why should that be a problem? Well, did I owe a duty to some person who wasn't even born yet? Well, and again, I'll kind of get ahead of myself a little bit here. I think I've referred to this in the past as the duty schmooty response. That is, when you pose a question like, does this person owe a duty? The response is, well, what kind of a question is that? Again, I'm giving you kind of my soapbox editorial opinion about why I don't start out you know, thinking that you can answer the duty question on the first day of school, or even the fifth day of school, or the 30th day of school. The duty question turns out to be an almost unmanageable question, certainly when you're starting out. It's not the first question you want to try to tackle. After you've played around with these cases, you can kind of come back to it. And in Dillon versus Legg, the court gives a kind of another sort of duty schmooty response to the idea that the defendant owes a duty to the mother watching her kid get killed in an intersection or in a motor vehicle collision. Does the defendant owe a duty to these children not yet in being? Well, yeah, that's an easy one, says the court. Actually, we haven't even gotten there yet. That's a wrongful life claim. But with respect to the parents, the doctor certainly owes the parents a duty to advise them, using reasonable care, to tell them about the kinds of risks that they face from the medical treatment that the doctor is providing. We'll talk more about medical malpractice in Chapter 10. But in any event, meanwhile, as we're working our way through the question of whether the parents have a claim for wrongful birth, the first notion, as you say, is, well, of course, the parents were owed a duty of reasonable care in the medical care they received. If the doctor negligently fails to inform them of risks from the medical treatment the doctor is prescribing, that's something the parents can collect for. What about all of the issues surrounding giving an award to the parents for the birth of a child? Why doesn't this pose the same worries that the dissent raised in the Arizona Health Sciences Center case? Mr. Sharma? Different case. Many courts would say, the strong majority of courts, even those courts that would agree with the dissent in the Arizona Health Sciences Center case, that normal, healthy children are a blessing, those same courts might say, well, wait a minute, it's different when the child is not born normal and healthy. There you have a much stronger claim for compensation. There the public policy behind providing compensation to the parents is greater. So the court, again, here doesn't have much difficulty saying somebody needs to pay for the special needs that these kids are going to have, and the logical person to pay for that is the negligent person whose negligence produced them. Even there, yeah, Mr. Phillips. Over on page 65, right-hand column on 65, middle of it, down a little bit from the middle, we begin with duty. The case, you know, in every case, the alleged negligence occurs before the birth, even before the conception of the child. But they say, but we've had, you know, for a long time we've held that you can sue. Again, if it were true that you only owed a duty to persons already in existence, then the two-year-old who's killed by a collapsing, you know, ceiling from a negligently constructed house, if the house was constructed before that child was conceived, the defendant can say, ha ha, you weren't around when I did my allegedly negligent act, therefore I didn't owe you a duty, and therefore I'm not liable. And courts have said, we don't buy that argument. Again, this is where I think the whole concept of trying to identify as though and we'll talk more about that in Dillon versus Legge, trying to first identify duty in the abstract. What the court says in Dillon versus Legge, and we do need to talk about this, whether this is a cynical response or not, what the court says in Dillon versus Legge is the duty question is second. The liability issue comes first. It's not like you say, was there a duty? Was it breached? Therefore, is there liability? What the court says in Dillon versus Legge is we decide whether or not a driver of a car should be liable to the mother who watches in horror as her daughter is fatally injured in an automobile accident. We decide first, should she recover damages? After we decide that question, we then tell you whether the driver owed her a duty. It doesn't happen the other way around. Now, you may look at that and say, well, that's a really result-oriented, cynical approach. Or you may say, well, finally somebody's telling it like it really is. That's what happens. And it should happen like that. We should, as a society, decide, should mothers who watch their daughters get run over be entitled to recover? Should the dad who's in the backyard mowing the lawn who doesn't see it but comes running out afterwards, should the dad who's across town who gets a telephone call, races to the scene, sees the blood, the glasses, the backpack on the ground, but doesn't see his daughter's dead body until he gets to the funeral home? You know, deciding who should recover in cases like that is not a function of, I wonder if there's a duty. And then following that question to its logical conclusion, the court in Dillon versus Legge says, let's face it, the way we do this is we say, should that person recover? And if they should recover, we say, oh, by the way, defendant, you owed a duty to this person or that person. Now, again, I want to get there to this whole question about where does duty come from? Who says who owes whom a duty? You know, these kind of deep philosophical questions. But for the moment, I want to kind of work our way through this question about what we're going to do specifically about kids like Elizabeth and Christine. Should their parents be able to file a wrongful birth claim? Do you feel differently about this case compared to Arizona Health Sciences Center case? And the other question, if you allow the parents to recover, should the children also be able to recover on some kind of separate wrongful life theory? But you go ahead. Okay. What's your nomenclature issue? Oh, well, I mean, that's a very good question, and I think in part it's lawyers, in the same way that lawyers will refer quite insensitively to a bad baby case. They'll refer to a dog bite case, a slip and fall. It's kind of a convenient handle. We have wrongful death claims. Well, this is a wrongful birth claim, wrongful life claim. It's sort of, you know, it's handy. We slap that label on. Does it contain within it a respect for the people who are involved? Obviously not. But I think before we worry about the labels, we should see what the actual ruling is, or what, you know, what we're actually doing here, what the court says is the legal rule. Go ahead. And on what basis can they recover? Okay, but how do we measure the damages here?
The medical hospital, medication,
the wear and tear. The whole package here, just as we had in the previous case, all of the costs, not only the costs associated with the birth of a normal, healthy child, but in addition, the costs of having a child with a disability or a series of disabilities. Now, does that have to be offset by the benefit to the parents? It does seem like the court is forgetting that it's engaging in a comparison of what would have been had these children not been born. It seems like they lapse into a garden variety case in which the measure of damages is the difference between having a disabled child as opposed to having a normal child. But in theory, at least, we would pursue the same methodology as in the previous case that the court adopted, namely looking at the debit side of the ledger. I can still see the outline here from yesterday. Again, we would make all of the list, and it might be a longer list, of the special needs that these children would have, but at the same time, we do have to offset that by the benefit to the parents. Well, and this is precisely the question at which I, as a parent of a child like this, would say, I was troubled in the last case that the parents would be forced, in order to get a recovery, to say unpleasant things about their child, but we might hope at least that they didn't really mean them. The really tragic thing in a case like this is that the parents probably at least flirt with the idea from time to time that they would be better off if they've never had these children. And of all the people that deserve a better welcome into this world, it ought to be people like Elizabeth and Christine, should it not? Maybe we can look at the Payman kids and say, you'll be fine. This recovery isn't going to bother you. Whatever your parents said to get some money out of this system, so be it. What the parents say in this case is a little bit too close to home. Should that lead a court, as the dissent wanted to in the previous case, to say, therefore, no recovery? To look to the Harbisons and say, Mr. and Mrs. Harbison, I know this is very expensive. I know these kids present special needs. I know, this is a big challenge for you. But to give you any recovery would be to say such a bad thing about your kids. We just won't do it. That's the way we're going to respect your children. I'm not sure I'm real happy with that. But, of course, the flip side is that we say, in effect, as a matter of law, we kind of take it for granted. Well, of course, there's no real benefit to these kids. Normal, healthy kid, they're a lot of trouble, but most of the time they're worth it. Sometimes not so sure. But, gee, these kids who have disabilities, who would want one of those? Again, that's not true in my case. I'd like you to meet my daughter. She's a wonderful human being. What can you say? But, again, what should the court be doing here? Should the court be engaged in a piety about, well, this is what we think as a society? Should the court turn to, in a pragmatic way, and simply say, hey, we got to find a way to get these parents some money here? And it really doesn't matter what we say. Let's just find a way to get them some money. Mr. Phillips. Okay. But is there... Yes, But remember the case that we're looking at, the doctors aren't responsible for giving them fetal height Antoine syndrome. The doctors are responsible for giving them life. Is their life a source of damage to the parents? On balance, are the parents worse off because they had Elizabeth and Christine? If we say, yes, they are worse off, and here's how we measure their damage, well, that's what we did in the Haman case. But if, on balance, we say, trouble, yes. Are normal children trouble? Absolutely. Are they worth it? We certainly hope so. We certainly don't want, as a society, to be in the business of saying, as a matter of law, here's all this money for the injury you suffered by having this child. Now, it gets worse. Because in the wrongful life claim, even more disturbing than the idea that the parents are in the courtroom saying, in effect, I want compensation because my life is worse off because I had this kid. Now the children are in court saying, we've been damaged because we're here. We would have been better off never to have been born. We have wrongful life. Now, it may pain us to respond to the parents who have said, my life is worse off. Leave your piety at home, please, the parents would say. It's all very well and good for you to say what a blessing this kid is. I'll tell you, for me, it was a source of injury. And as a society, we might say, gee, it's really too bad you have that attitude, but after all, you did have this procedure, the doctor messed it up, the pharmaceutical company messed it up. Okay, we're sorry you feel that way, but here's your damage. It's a very different thing when the children walk in and we say, you would be better off if you had never been born. And here's the money to you for your injury. Ms. Ma? Well, and again, the part of the difficulty here is that the tort system has to provide an answer to these questions one way or the other. When the parents show up saying, here's our injury, here's the compensation we need, the court either says, I'm sorry, we can't go there, we can't do this. Or maybe there's a way we can do it with a better label, but to be honest, Mr. Phillips, my suspicion is we're kind of like the ophthalmology case, whatever that was called, Helling versus Carey, where the concurring opinion says we need a different label here. But it's the same thing, isn't it? No matter what label you put on it, if the underlying structure of this is a judicial determination that the birth of these children is a source of damage to their parents or to themselves, frankly, I don't think changing the label is going to change the reality of what we're doing. Maybe I'm wrong, though. True. That is the question. To be or not to be, as Hamlet said, yeah. Who, the parents or the... Yeah. But let's talk about the kids for a moment, and let's get the actual ruling of the court on this point. So the kids now have this claim for wrongful life. What does the court say about that? How do we measure the damage? At that point, they state it correctly. Again, from the children's perspective, you could say, in what respect am I worse off than if I had never existed? Well, obviously, I have bills to pay because I've never existed, but that's, you know, compared to what is always the question. And one answer to the problem would be, well, we have no basis for comparison. We give up. We're going home now. But the court is driven by this notion. It's a practical problem. The court says that the parents are going to be liable, not, well, the parents are responsible for their kids until the kids reach the age of 18. But beyond the age of 18, they no longer have the obligation to support these children. So it's at that point the court says somebody needs to pay for their education, you know, vocational training, et cetera, whatever medical needs they have. And at that point the court reverts, as you'll note, to paying for the extraordinary costs. Again, it's not existence versus non-existence, it's the impaired condition versus normal condition. You got to pay for the therapy, the education, so forth. That doesn't really track the comparison of life to no life at all. But again, the court only does that with respect to the economic loss. With respect to the non-economic loss, remember that with respect to the parents' claim for wrongful birth, the court says that is governed by they're entitled to the pain and suffering, the worry, the concern, the disappointment, the anxiety of having a child at all. But in this case, actually, they wanted children. They just didn't want children with this level of disability. Ms. Williams. I mean, it would certainly damage the credibility, or at least it would undercut their argument when, in effect, it's a comparison of different disabilities. I signed on for this, but not for this. And here again, I mean, look at how close we are to some very touchy issues about people who say, yeah, I want kids, but only under these conditions. And even I must, you know, I'm, as a parent, having, I have four children, and Robin, my daughter with Down syndrome, was our third. And we thought we were done. And then my wife discovers that she's pregnant with number four. And she was 42, 43 at the time. I mean, we didn't want to have more children at that point. Now, Peter, he'll be 14 on Sunday. We're very glad he's here. But he had actually a 1 in 20 chance of having Down syndrome, because that was the risk factor. So I didn't want to have a child at that point. So everybody's in that boat to some extent. At what point, though, do you say, if the parents say, which other parents would agree with, hey, if the risk is too great, I'll pass. I don't want to have more children on that basis. Let me tell you a little story here. Another question that comes up is why they had a second child. Okay, it usually comes up when I teach this question, or teach this case, And here's the explanation that I usually give. Elizabeth was born with fetal Ida-Antoin syndrome, but when Robin was born with Down syndrome, it's not, I mean, we knew right away, we suspected right away, not all parents of kids with Down syndrome know right away, it's discovered later on. Even if they knew that Elizabeth had a problem, remember the doctors had told her, here are the risks, cleft palate, fetal hirsutism. They're not thinking, oh, it's the Dilantin, maybe it's our genes, maybe it's the water we drank, whatever, maybe it's just bad luck. Only when Christine shows up do they realize there's a pattern here to react to. Well, I'm teaching this 1 year, and I answer that question as best I can, go back to the student who was reciting, and the student says, that's right, the parents didn't know. And I said, And I suddenly looked at his name card, and it was Michael Harbison. You'd think I would have thought about that, don't you? I would have made the connection, Eastern Washington. Anyway, I picked on him because he's got a name that matches this name, and we'd had this conversation. And he said, no, the parents didn't know. Do you know the family? Yeah, they're my sisters. Hey, it's a rather strange moment, as you can imagine. And thank goodness I had, you know, I immediately at that point freeze framed, you know, when your life is passing in seconds. I rewound the tape, thought, what incredibly stupid things have I said in the last 20 minutes that I'd like to have back right now? But because we shared a lot of the same situation, I fortunately hadn't said anything hopelessly stupid. And we went on, and I talked about, you know, he graduated. His sisters graduated from high school. Did sound like the condition was a lot like Down syndrome. His parents eventually got a settlement from the government. Took forever, finally got some money, that's the way it was. Now, you know, I still think there are real troubling issues about if you were a parent in this situation, if you were a lawyer representing these people. Also, just on that little story, it's a good reminder periodically that the people we talk about, not always in reverent terms, they're real people, they have families, they have feelings. I'm often kind of cavalier about this. I remember for one brief shining moment, then I'm back to my macabre self again. But it is a good sort of bracing thing. Yeah, for everybody, what if they were here? What if we were talking about their sisters, their family, and so forth? Okay. Well, again, this is where the case goes to the heart of what's, gee, you know, none of us is a perfect parent. Whatever devotion we have to our children is limited by our sense of resources. To what extent does the tort system account for all of these really delicate things, that we are really a bull in a china shop here as we wreck things in our desire to get stuff done. Speaking of getting stuff done, I'm going to spend a very short amount of time with Taylor versus Kuropaty. It's mostly there, and I apologize for the length. I should have edited it down so it was a little more compact. But it's a good summary of the law. It's a good statement of a view about this case. And anyway, we'll talk about that briefly on Monday. Then we'll press on with Dylan.